Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. You know what we're having today? Ooh, I got a phrase for it. The providential poetry of the Parsha. Not bad, huh? Providential, how things get orchestrated sometimes in such a way that they have meaning in terms of what's actually going on. So, as Stacy pointed out, today, one of our passages in this particular Parsha and this particular Sidra, this particular section of the Parsha, is about a husband and a wife. Because the basic point I want to make, and this is what this is all about, is this. The other-centered life is the best life. You got that? The other-centered life is the best life. And I'm going to demonstrate this from our Torah portion, but also from our Besorah. So, again, it says in our portion, if a man has recently married, he must not be sent to war or have any other duty laid on him. For 1 year he's be free to stay at home and bring happiness, simcha, to his wife, the wife he has married. What is this all about? In the Torah, it's about the fact that for 1 year, and Stacy mentioned this, but for 1 year, the newly married couple is to not have to worry about going to war. And think about it from the perspective of the new wife. She has to, if he were to go to war, she has to worry, what's going to be? Will he come back maimed? Will he be dead? You see? And so what we find here is God builds in this sensibility, this kind of other-centeredness, this kind of awareness not only of the material needs of people, which we're definitely going to talk about in the Parsha, but also the emotional needs, the deeper needs. And we tend to think of the biblical world as being kind of devoid of psychological insight, but that is not true. True, we don't have those kind of insights predominate as we would in a post-Freudian kind of world that we live in. But nonetheless, what we find in subtle fashion is an accounting for how love can be expressed, not just to meet physical needs, but also to meet the deeper emotional, the deepest needs where we all live as human beings and where people did back then as well. So no military service. See, the Torah's emphasis is toward the vulnerable, toward the one who might be in trouble, toward the one who needs the other-centeredness of the people around them. The other-centered life is the best life. That's where we're going with all this. So then, in the next verse of our portion, it says, do not take a pair of millstones, not even the upper one, as security for a debt, because that would take a person's livelihood as security. Security means collateral. It's what you put up to be able to get a loan. Again, in the Torah, there is a favoring of the borrower, not the creditor. There is a tilt in the way Torah functions toward the person who is a bit more vulnerable because they're borrowing, not the creditor. So when we think about our own day, do you realize where interest rates on credit cards are right now? 22.5%, and that's if your credit is good. What if it's not good? And I mention it because I was talking to a young man the other day who was completely ruined because he lost his job. He was forced to use his credit card to buy groceries and to live. And then, because he had trouble making the exorbitant monthly payments, he used his credit card to actually pay on the credit card. Well, do you know where that leads? Can you imagine in a short time? And he's still, years later, suffering from the effects of that. Though he works and he's gainfully employed and tries very hard to pay it off, it becomes really, really difficult. Well, in the Torah, it's not that way. In the Torah, there is, again, a tilt. So what does it mean? It means, in this particular passage, that when you're a creditor and you want to take something or offered something as collateral. You're not to take away the means of a person's livelihood as collateral. You got what I'm saying about that? You can't take the millstone, the thing that he uses to grind up his flour. You can't do that because that will hurt him. The tilt is in the direction of the person who borrows. Let me give you another example. It's from verse 10. When you make a loan of any kind to your neighbor, do not go into their house to get what is offered to you as a pledge. Stay outside and let the neighbor to whom you are making the loan bring the pledge out to you. Well, maybe you wonder, well, what's the value of that practically? Why does he have to stay outside? Why can't he come in for a cup of coffee? I believe that the reason here, again, is not in the realm of the obvious, but in the realm of the deeper human needs for a sense of dignity. When you invite the creditor in your house, it may be that you're a very poor person, and you don't want that guy in your house because you're poor, and the place might be a mess, and your furniture may not be great. I could speak from personal experience on this one. When I was growing up, it wasn't that we were in abject poverty by American standards, but we were pretty well on the low end, and our house was a wreck. In fact, I didn't bring any friends to my house until I was 15 years old, out of sheer embarrassment because of what the place looked like. And so this idea of the shaming factor, so you don't invite the person to whom you've borrowed into your house because it's shaming. God does not want the person who's borrowed to feel the sense of insecurity that having this person in the house come in and say, well, wait a minute, you know what? Why don't you, instead of paying me that debt, let me take that, that, and that, and that. I mean, anything can happen, right? And so there's an awareness of the deeper psychological needs of a person. Let me go on one more. This is verse 12. If the neighbor is poor, do not sleep with his pledge as a possession. Return their cloak by sunset so that your neighbor may sleep in it. Then they will thank you, and it will be regarded as a righteous act in the sight of the Lord your God. Tehiyat tzadik lifnei Adonai Elohecha. It'll be regarded as tzedakah. Now, what does this mean? Well, here we are really in the realm of just the practical, but there's also that human side of it. If someone gives you their cloak as collateral, it's not right to keep it overnight. You've got to give it back to him so he can sleep in it, so he can stay warm. If you got to get it back the next day because it's collateral for a loan, you can get it back, but you can't keep it overnight. You have to care for the person who's vulnerable, the person who you have loaned money to. And again, what we see here, we can summarize this way. The other-centered life is the best. All of these things implicitly are leading Israel to a kind of empathic attitude toward others, a kind of attitude that says, let me step into your shoes and feel what you're feeling. And I can tell you that other contemporary law codes, there's one called the Code of Hammurabi, for example, there's other codes, that is, you know, legal codes from that period, they were not compassionate this way. There was no tilt in the direction of the needy. There was no accounting for their needs, their emotional and spiritual needs. That wasn't it. It was just the power and the king and his nobles. And hey, if you have bad luck, sorry, that's the way it goes. But the Torah is tilted in a different direction. We could put it this way. There's some words that we think of when we think of justice and the legal realities that are part of life. One is tzedek. And we think of the famous passage, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, righteousness, tzedek, tzedek, righteousness, righteousness shall you pursue, or often translated, justice, justice shall you pursue. Very famous passage. It's an idea of justice, doing the right thing for the right reasons. And there's another stronger term, mishpat. And the idea is that with mishpat, it's just cut and dried in the sense that the judges were not to show any partiality this way and partiality this way. Very, very important principle, and one we'd stand by. But tzedek has more the idea of the compassionate element built into the way the word functions, and we think of the word tzedakah. It's doing the right and decent thing in all circumstances, and sometimes that goes beyond even the strictly legal dimensions of the Torah. And so we have that. It's justice tempered by compassion. Again, what are we talking about? We're talking about God's trajectory, the trajectory of the Torah, what he's trying to infuse into Israel, and by extension, the whole world, you know, and that idea that you're not just thinking about yourself, but you're thinking about the deeper needs of the people that you're dealing with, particularly those who are vulnerable because of the way life has turned out for them, or even sometimes because of their own errors. Now, let's take a look at Yeshua in this very poignant encounter with his main guy, and that is, in English we say Peter, comes from the word meaning rock, he's a rock, but his name in Hebrew is Kepha, and so just for the sake of keeping it within our context, I'll use his Hebrew name as I speak about this, okay? What we find in this situation is Yeshua's response to him in light of what happened very short time before that, when Kepha denied Yeshua three times. He had all kinds of bravado before that. Yeshua says he's going to be arrested and it's going to be very bad for him. And Kepha throws out his chest and says, I'll never desert you. I'm with you to the end. And Yeshua says to himself, oh yeah? Well, we'll see. Okay. And then when the chips were down, Yeshua was arrested. Then Kepha gave in to the temptation and he denied Yeshua those three times. Says that after it, he wept bitterly. He felt horrible about what he had done. But this is what he had done. At this point, this is at the very end, just after the resurrection, Yeshua has revealed himself to his followers, and you can read the chapter for all the details there. And here, he's speaking alone to Kepha. And what he does, he affirms Kepha's leadership despite his moral failing. You know, he did weep tears of remorse when he denied Yeshua, so there was genuine repentance there. But he needs Messiah's reassurance if he's going to be able to fulfill his destiny. That's the context. We're going to look at it a little bit here. When they had finished eating, Yeshua said to Shimon Kepha, Shimon, his other Hebrew name, Shimon, people had multiple names. I'll call him Kepha. Kepha, son of John, do you love me more than these other people who are standing nearby? Do you love me more than them? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Yeshua said, feed my lambs. Again, Yeshua said, Shimon, son of John, Kepha, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Yeshua said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Shimon, son of John, do you love me? Kepha was hurt because Yeshua asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Yeshua said, feed my sheep. Now, what's going on here? I believe that what's happening is that Yeshua's forcing or evoking from Kepha his commitment verbally three times in a row is going to help solidify Kepha's resolve for what has to happen in the months and years and decades ahead. In other words, it's an act of love. He is strengthening him by helping him affirm these things verbally and unequivocally. Because the fact of the matter is, not long before this, his love for the master was in question. In fact, it was in serious doubt because he denied him three times. So here, he says to Kepha, I want you to affirm, what is your commitment here really? And he knows how it's all going to end up, but he wants for Kepha's sake to be able to say these things. And I want to suggest to you that even hurting his feelings here, says his feelings are, you know that I love you. Sometimes in the process of healing someone, the other-centered life, you got to hurt them a little bit. You have to say things that are tough. You have to do things that don't evoke immediate positive emotions, but rather for the long haul, you do what's necessary and say what's necessary because you want the best for that person. What's our point this morning? It's the other-centered life, which is the best life. And I think that Yeshua here, in part, I don't think it's his whole motivation, but significantly his motivation is to evoke from Peter the Those feelings, that sense of release, that sense of forgiveness, that sense of resolve, so that he could feel like a mensch again. Because believe me, Kepha, to some extent, is out of touch with the depth of guilt and how he has felt about how he treated the Messiah just weeks before. Again, he thought he was such a big shot, and all of a sudden, he realized that he was not quite the guy he thought he was. Yeshua wants to build him up. But sometimes that means a bit of tough love. Okay, so he's teasing out the deeper issue. Lord, you know that I love you, is the issue in question after Kepha's denial of Yeshua. And so he's helping him resolve that. Then he says, verily, verily, I say to you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you were old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you to where you do not want to go, Yeshua said. This to indicate the time of death by which Kepha would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. Now, is there love by him pointing out that ultimately his future is going to end in death? And by the way, this happened. He was crucified upside down in Rome. Assuring him that despite the great challenges he'd face, Kepha was destined for a noble life. His denial of Yeshua days earlier would completely evaporate because of the kind of life that he was being called to. You see, when you foul up, you feel like, you feel crummy. And Yeshua is saying, listen, let's put that away. You're going to have a noble life. You're going to suffer for the sake of the kingdom of God. It is true. It's not going to be easy for you, but it's okay because I am calling you to nobility. So let's put away all that past stuff. That's all past. That's gone. Meanwhile, you feed my sheep. And then it goes on, but I'm not going to continue with this theme. We could talk more about this. Yeshua loves all the Talmidim. Yeshua loves all the Talmidim, but he had a special calling on Kepha. Now, of course, in some communions, Kepha is viewed as in the Roman Catholic tradition, he's viewed as the Pope, and that's not our angle. But it's absolutely undeniable, that Kepha had a very prominent position among all the other followers. And Yeshua is restoring his inner world so he can accept that position well. Yeshua is thinking about what Kepha needs to keep in mind and what he needs to be resolved of so he could live his best life. Now, here's the paradox about the other-centered life. This is the great paradox. We imagine that if our motivations as we live every day is to really ask, what do other people need? We imagine that somehow that takes away from us. And it can. I can think of situations, abusive situations, where it's not where you begin. You got self-preservation is the critical thing. But in general, and what I want to exhort all of us to, is to take upon ourselves an attitude, a mentality, approach to life, which starts much more with the needs of others, not just their physical needs, but their emotional needs. What does she need as my new bride that she could be the happiest girl in the world? What does he need? What does my wife need? What do my kids need? What do the rabbis need? Hey, why not? Right, Rabbi Nathan? We can ask that now and then, right? I think it's a fair question. What does everyone need in the community? And I want to suggest that if we choose to live this way, we invite God's smile on our lives. And living this way doesn't diminish you. It doesn't make you less. The self-absorbed life will suck the life out of you. You'll dry up like a prune. The life that is expansive and which is other-centered at a very deep level is an expansive, strength-filled life. It's a life much more conducive to joy, much more conducive to strength, to inner resilience, to the ability to really have a terrific life. It is the best life because, first and foremost, we live with a sense of God's smile the sense of the passage we read, Tehiyeh tzedaka lifnei Adonai Elohecha, you shall sense God's smile on the other acted because of the other-centered life that we live. Just keep this in mind again. The other-centered life is your and my best life. Shabbat shalom, everyone.
Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Messiah.